is Steve Sherlock with another in a series of Franklin Matters radio shows, number 258 in the series. This session of the radio show shares the Economic Development Subcommittee meeting held April 27, 2020, via virtual conference bridge to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. The meeting was led by Committee Chair Melanie Hamblin. Each person thereafter is identified as they speak for this virtual meeting. The one agenda item for discussion was an inclusionary zoning bylaw proposal. As you listen to the meeting, the presentation of the proposal, then discussion and comments by members of the committee, then planning board, and others. Ultimately, the feedback will be incorporated into some tweaks for this measure to be brought back to the committee before going to the town council to begin the formal approval process sometime in the near future. For reference, the process at the town council would first refer to the planning board. The planning board would hold a public hearing, take comments, and vote on a recommendation to send back to the council. At that point, the council would also schedule their public hearing, and if moving forward, require two readings before the vote on the bylaw. Now, technically, the proposal could fall out in this process, but given the consensus discussions so far, it will likely be modified to ensure approval. The recording runs about an hour and 20 minutes, so let's listen to the Economic Development Subcommittee meeting of April 27, 2020.
Okay, well, I think we can start. We have a forum, right? So I think we'll, I'm gonna read all this. Hi, Tony. I will read the script that Councillor Mercer has read before. And here we go. okay, as a preliminary matter, this is Melanie Hamblin. Permit me to confirm that all members and persons anticipated to be on the agenda are present and can hear me. So I'm going to call out your name, and when I call out your name, just say if you're here or not. Okay? So, Councillor Bersanti.
Here.
Thank you. Councillor Earls. I don't see him on the list, so. Councillor Jones.
Here.
Thank you.
Present.
We have some of the town staff members on the call as well. Town Administrator Jamie Helen.
Present.
Thank you. Assistant to the Town Administrator Chrissy Welton.
Here.
Thank you. Director of Community Planning and Development Brian Tabiner.
Here.
Thank you. And the town planner, Amy Love.
Here, thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. This open meeting of the Franklin Economic Development Subcommittee is being conducted remotely consistent with Governor Baker's executive order of March 12, 2020. Due to the current state of emergency in the Commonwealth from the outbreak of COVID-19 virus, in order to mitigate the transmission of COVID-19, we have been advised and directed by the Commonwealth to suspend public gatherings, and as such, the governor's order suspends the requirement of the open meeting law to have all meetings in a publicly accessible physical location. Further, all members of the public bodies are allowed and encouraged to participate remotely. The order, which you can find posted with agenda materials for this meeting, allows public bodies to meet entirely remotely, so long as reasonable public access is afforded so that the public can follow along with the deliberations of the meeting. Ensuring public access does not ensure public participation unless participation is required by law. This meeting will feature public comment. For this meeting, the Franklin Economic Development Subcommittee is convening by telephone, video conference via the Zoom application, as posted on the town website, identifying how the public may join. Please note that this meeting is being recorded and that some attendees are participating by video conferencing. Accordingly, please be aware that other folks may be able to see you, and take care not to screen share your computer Anything that you broadcast may be captured in the recording. All supporting materials that have been provided to members of this body are available on the town's website, unless they're on the town's website. The public is encouraged to follow along using the posted agenda unless I note otherwise. So there's some business ground rules that we need to follow. So I will go to the first item on the agenda, but before we do so, permit me to cover some ground rules. I will introduce each speaker on the agenda. After they conclude their remarks, the chair will go, I will go down the line of members, inviting each of the name to provide any comment, questions, or motions. Please remember to mute your phone or computer when you are speaking. Please remember to speak clearly in a way that helps generate accurate minutes. For any response, please wait until the chair yields the floor to you and state your name before speaking. So what we'll do is I will have the members of the subcommittee ask the questions, and then we'll go to the other people when you raise your hand. If you go to the participant list on the right side, you can see where it says raise your hand. Just raise your hand and I'll call on you. And I think first we're going to turn to the first item on the agenda, which is a discussion on the inclusionary zoning bylaw proposal that was part of our on our to-do list. So we're going to do it. So we're going to start to discuss this. And this is our first time discussing it. So I am going to turn it over to Jamie and then probably Brian after that. So Jamie.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for everybody for attending tonight's meeting. So I'm just going to, as Councilor Hamlin mentioned, I'm just going to run through a quick intro and then pass it over to our planning director to go through a little bit more of the section by section nuts and bolts. But it's just a bit of a lead off. You know, this is an issue that we've been trying to gain some headway with for quite some time. I know it predates me to some degree. I think we've all heard from many concerns from residents about the affordable housing crisis in the community. I think this is an issue that predates the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think that it's one that, you know, regardless how all of this turns out in the coming months, is still going to be an issue in Franklin as in the years in the future. And, you know, we've heard about this from ranging from a whole different aspects of town, ranging from people who may be struggling to own a home, who may be homeless or in a transit situation. And I think the thing that we hear about at least most often is that many children or grandchildren of lifelong Franklinites who are unable to afford a home or rental in a traditional middle-class family in the community can afford has become a growing concern in the community as Franklin, obviously, in the last 10 years, the housing values have, the median housing value has certainly gone up throughout all of the state, but certainly in Franklin as well. And as that median price continues to rise in the future, I think that this problem will continue on. I do want to mention that the communities around of us, including Medway, Bellingham, Wrentham, Norfolk, these communities all have had some sort of an inclusionary zoning bylaw. I'm going to leave it to Brian to go through the details. Ours differentiates a tiny bit from them, but the premise of the entire bylaw is very similar. And there's a couple of different sections in the proposal that will hopefully accommodate different demographics within the community. I just want to thank, Brian and the town attorney, Mark, for all of their efforts, as well as our entire tech review staff with the building inspector and the town engineer and Amy Love, our town planner, for spending a tremendous amount of time in recent years to really look at the trends across the state and particularly in our region. And they've put a tremendous amount of time in into what we think is a very thoughtful proposal. It's certainly not an issue that is going to take care of everybody's concern in the community. It's not something that if this bylaw were passed in a month, we're going to be able to all of a sudden provide a whole slew of units for everybody. But I do think that this is one thing that the town of Franklin can do right now to set us up for near-term and long-term success in addressing these issues that unquestionably in the long run are going to become more difficult in Franklin as Franklin becomes a more a community that more people want to live in. And as generations continue to move on, it's just difficult. So with that as a little bit of an intro, I'm going to pass it over to Brian to talk to a few more of the mechanics. And then I'd also like to give your discretion, Madam Chair, I'd like to give the town attorney, Mark Sorrell, a few moments after Brian's done to offer any feedback that he may. He's done a tremendous amount of work on this, and he's got a lot of historical knowledge, and I think it'd be good to hear from Mark as well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Jamie. Yep. Okay, so Brian.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening.
So inclusionary zoning is something that the planning department has been working on now for a long time. For one reason or another, it hasn't gone forward. I'm glad that Jamie is finally allowing this thing to go forward. I think the council members, at least several of them, seem to be interested in this time. And I would like to see this taken seriously as you are. The bylaw is a little different than some of the other inclusionary bylaws that we've seen. And that is that so 25% of the units are to be inclusionary units, as we're calling them. So if you can go to the definition section of the bylaw, the fourth definition is inclusionary units. That is the 25%. And there are two different types of inclusionary units, which are also in the definitions, one being affordable units, which are 80% of the area-wide median income household. And that's what you would be doing if you were going for a 40B project. They have to, they would be in that category. So it's set by HUD and also by Commonwealth's Department of Housing and Community Development. So we would have 15% would be affordable units, and then an additional 10% would be considered a moderate income unit. And that is the 100% of median area-wide median household income, which is the same thing, that the same dollar amount that is used for the Community Preservation Act. If we were to ever get into that, those numbers would be the same dollar amount as that we'd qualify for. So the eligible household would be household would either qualify for the 80% or the 100%. And most inclusionary zoning bylaws do not do that. They focus in on, of course, the affordable units, 80%. But we do know that in town there are a lot of people that would not qualify for that, but still need, still want to be here and can't afford to purchase a house otherwise. So I think it'll meet two different needs, which is what we're trying to do.
Can I interrupt you for a second, Brian?
Please, yep.
I'm wondering if Chrissy could mute the person that's on the phone right now. The last digits are 2018. Thank you. All right, go ahead, thanks.
All right, thank you. Can you hear me? I can always turn mine up here.
No, I can hear you, but there was a lot of background noise.
Okay, all right. So the projects that this would apply to are any multifamily housing unit projects that are three units or more. Okay, so right now in our zoning, we have a single family housing, we have duplexes, and we have a multifamily, which is three or more housing units. So this would apply to any zoning district in any project of three or more housing units. And in this case, and in all cases for three or more, it's a planning board public hearing and special permit for this project. So if you have a project that you have, you want to put in 20 different housing units, for instance, you go to the planning board for a special permit, and you have to have 25% of those units as affordable, as either they are considered inclusionary units where they would fall into either affordable or moderate income, okay? So when you do the math, it's a little funky if you're only having three or four or five units. You're only going to be putting one of those units would be affordable. So you would have a choice on what type of unit you would have, either at the 80% or the 100%. As I mentioned, it would be always be a special permit through the planning board. And the units, now, there are options instead of providing the 25% units on site. You can work on a project where you have 25% of the units are on a locus offsite. So you can actually have, essentially it's two different projects that you're working on, where inclusionary one area and not on the other project. And that may be two different developers working together, or that could be working with the town in Affordable Housing Trust. I don't know. It's really good for the developer to get creative on what way they're going to do it. Other possibilities are donation of land, which would be equal to the value of the affordable units. So those are some things in there. We can get into fine details if you want, but in general, those are the categories that we're looking at. All right. So it just goes into, you know, the different fractions of if it's anywhere from under 5.5, you end up with less. If it goes 5.5 or more, you're going to have one more. We go into definitions of the affordable units, moderate income units, and things of that nature. And then we go with the provisions of these things on site. When you start the construction, there are a certain percentage of units that need to be constructed. In other words, if you have 30% of your units constructed, at least the next unit has to be an affordable unit, for instance. And there's a chart on in section G that applies to that.
I see it.
It's like backwards though, isn't it?
Yep. No, it's not backwards.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay. So the one thing I want to point out is the minimum design and construction standards for inclusionary units. They have to be of equivalent to the other area. So you can't have, a whole bunch of beautiful units that, and then a couple of shacks in the back for the inclusionary units. They have to mix in with the development. They have to be to the best ability. Now on the inside, for instance, if you want to, the developer wants to get more money for units with granite countertops opposed to some other countertops. But you have to have a base level type of unit to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then you add on the different additional costs, essentially. It's been done in town. It's done all the time. It's not something that's brand new by any means. All units that we have, the developer had come up with a marketing plan for the inclusionary units. That's what we do now. Maxine Kindhart deals with the units that we have for sale, for instance, in planning department. But most rentals, for instance, they deal directly with the state and does not add additional work to the town, actually. They deal directly with them with the marketing plans and the requirements. offsite, I guess we can talk about the offsite. And instead of having the on-site, as which is in Section G, you can have an alternative, which is it's another location where we can have the inclusionary units. So we do realize if you're going to put up, somebody wants to do 50 condominiums and they want to sell them at $1 million a piece, you're not going to be able to put inclusionary zoning on that property. It'd be very difficult, obviously, to do so. But the idea of this is to get 25% units that are one way or the other affordable to the different populations in our community. So they can be working on two different locations at the same time, for instance. Now the initial sale, the town will be heavily involved, the Municipal Affordable Housing Trust, for instance. Our department will be working on it. After the initial sale of the units, they continue to come back here and when they are resold. So the town gets to go after make sure that they are in the appropriate hands again and again and again. If they're rental units, that does not apply. We don't actually do that, but they have to stick to the standards and they have to answer to the state for that. Can I think if there's anything else that really, you can get into some fine detail, but the reality is the resale of the units have to come back to the town. I think I'd be happy to take some questions on it, but it's always a little bit too much detail in these things to give you a good, but that is a basic summary of what it's all about. I'd be happy to talk with anybody, answer questions. I think you're going to talk with Mark. Mark, you may have some things to add on.
Okay. Well, thanks, Brian. So we're going to go to Mark Sorrell, and then we'll go to questions after that. Okay?
Hello.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi. Can you hear us?
I can hear. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. So, this has gone through several iterations and draft. I've reviewed it, and it's within a permissible range in terms of what it's proposing to do. There's a policy decision being made that of the inclusionary units, a portion of them will qualify for the state subsidized housing inventory, and then the 10% that are called moderate will not qualify for credit, but on the other hand, they would qualify for use of community preservation funds were the town to adopt that. And it also addresses a large segment of the population that has a need of housing and right now is caught between being overqualified, making too much money to qualify for subsidized, but not making enough to be able to compete in the market. So rather than say anything else, perhaps if anyone has any legal questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. So I think what we'll do is I'm going to go through the subcommittee. So we're going to start with Andy, Councilor Bassanti, and please ask, let us know who you want to answer the questions first, okay? If you can, we might not be able to.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Through the chair, I suppose to Mark Sorrell. Mark, by the way, thank you everyone who's worked on this over the years. I've been talking about this for some time now, but I just have a question to Mark. Mark, what happens to land that's designed by right that could have a certain amount of units? Does this still go into effect if a piece of land by right can have 8 units? Does this anticipated bylaw still kick in on the 25%, or is this just mandated across the boards?
It's basically a revision to the zoning bylaw. So number one, there is a potential for certain property owners to be grandfathered before it's adopted. Number two, because it's subject to zoning, nothing's really as of right. So this is making a multifamily by special permit with this component in it. So as long as you're talking zoning, you can make this applicable across the board.
Yes, I'd like to follow up with one more question, Madam Chairman. So I don't know if I understood Brian Taberna correctly. Can this apply to a single family subdivision of like say 25, Brian? Did I hear you correctly? Or is this, when you say multifamily, do you mean multiple units?
So,
multifamily zoning?
So I'd kind of volunteer the answer here because it's a legal issue if Brian doesn't mind.
That's fine.
I don't mind.
All right, so this does not apply to single family development under the subdivision control law because legally there's a distinction between what you alluded to, Andy, as of right construction, which can take place under the subdivision control law if you comply with that statute and all local reasonable rules and regulations. So a decision was made based on the current state of the law to exempt single-family subdivision development from the application here. There's also a zoning, an issue within Massachusetts of a court decision which raises questions about whether you can add a layer of zoning over and above subdivision control.
So a single-family developer can still build single families and not be subjected to have to be 25% of his units?
That's correct. If you were to address that, the better way to go and the legally sound way to go would be what's called basically incentive, whereby you allow the developer additional density or additional units if he agrees or if he or they agree to include affordable properties, but that hasn't been addressed here.
Right, and I'm glad you touched upon that, Mark, because I'm kind of liking a lot of what I see here, but I would have thought we would give some more incentive. I want to see this happen, so I think I'd like to see developers at least be able to take advantage of some incentives to take advantage of this bylaw if it goes forward. So with that said, I'll just release the floor now to any other comments from any of the other subcommittee members. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Basanti. I am going to go to Councillor Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like Andy said, I'm in favor of this too. Obviously, I know Brian, we've been working on this for years. We've been discussing this for a long time. I'd like to see this move forward. I mean, really, we've talked about it so often. I really don't think there's much more to talk about. So with that, I'll just pass it over to you.
Any other further questions? No, you're done with that, with your questions. I have a couple of things I wanted to ask. So I did think at first we were designed kind of like an overlay zone, but for this, but I like the idea to allow affordable and moderate housing all over the town. I think it's a good thing for people to be able to afford a moderate house somewhere. I feel like Brian could correct me if I am incorrect, but I think the provision to do units off-site actually helps the developers as well, because we want this to be fair to developers, we want it to be fair to everybody, and that's the only way it's really going to work well, I think. And I just wanted to clarify one thing so Brian can answer this as well. So the threshold with the developments of five or less units, so then the developer can then decide which is it going to be affordable or a moderate. Is that correct?
Correct.
If they have like one unit that needs to become either or.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to thank everybody the staff for putting this together. It's very thorough. It has everything in it. But I think what we'll do now is, I think Joe has a question, right, Joe? So I'm gonna give my floor over to Joe Halligan right now. So please state your name, address, for people to know who's speaking next. Thank you.
Hi, Joe Halligan, Wonderful Drive, Vice Chair, Planning Board. I've done a lot of homework on this in the last week or two and a lot of studying. I do believe we're on the right track. I just believe that there's a lot of mechanics behind this that have to be worked on. And some of those are, I visited a lot of sites in other towns that really have moved forward with this, similar to what we are. But there was a lot of incentives that were given to the developers to allow this to happen. And but that's by means of tax breaks, overriding zoning, giving them additional stories to allow to compensate for the amount of money they're going to spend. And in some towns where the land was scarce and an individual had the right to put 5 units in, which would trigger 1.5 affordable, he would actually put 3 units in at a much larger expense, a bigger 3 units, which basically increased the values of homes, even existing homes in the community, without adding anything to the affordable. And if they had frontage on a road, they would subdivide the lots to put 3 expensive units per lot rather than having a 10-acre lot and having this trigger them to do that. Another one of the questions was, because I did a lot of homework, some developers had issues with, they would put 40 units in, 20 would have to be affordable. But condos, and this would fall under condos, he had a hard time selling those 20%. It took a couple of years to even get them filled, if that. Who's responsible for paying the taxes on those empty units, the heat, the light, if they don't sell on the affordable part? Some towns, the housing authority stepped in and would buy the 25 units or 20 units, whatever the percentage was. And this way here, the man was able to obtain financing to put the project up, because obviously financing is the main key issue here to build these projects. A bank is not going to finance a project like this on 20 empty units. So the housing authorities would actually come in and he would have those pre-sold. It's a win-win for the developer and for the community. A lot of them bypassed zoning. They didn't have to put the granite curbing in. Sometimes they allowed them to bypass planning board, so they wouldn't have to go through all the expense. Some of them eliminated I&I fees, sewer water connection fees, to allow a developer to come in town and be excited about building something like this. Because at the cost of material and land, which is something a developer can't control, believe it or not, that 25% is the profit. So therefore, the first out of 100 units, 75 would be break even. In 100 units, 25 would be the profit, but if they're affordable, there's no money to be made. So the incentives are what entices these people to move forward with these projects. Again, I did a lot of study. I went to a lot of towns. The town of Newton put this in effect, and in the past 10 years, it's only raised the percentage 1% in the town of Newton with inclusionary zoning. Not really what they expected, because people skirt around. Like I said, they'll subdivide the land. They'll find a way to put 3 expensive units in versus 5 lower priced units where 2 could be affordable. I think we're on the right track, but maybe allowing just a quick example, and I'll let someone else comment or anybody wants to jump in. If there's a piece of land in downtown Franklin and 5 units are allowed to be built, but zoning says only 5, if there was something, if this was in place, would allow him to build 10 units on that parcel to make it worth it, to compensate for the land cost and construction. Again, I'm just bouncing around different ideas that other people have done. And then my last comment would be, because I see they use the DNAV project as a poster child on this. That definitely would not have worked, and I know the mechanics of that project. It would not have worked on this. If you can remember, we went to a tech review meeting. Whoever was there, who's on screen tonight was in a tech review. The developer came in and they pretty much computerized what it would cost to build that project according to the Franklin standards, granite curbing, the sidewalks, the landscape, and everything that this community wants from everybody, which I believe is the right way to do it. When they added up the cost to put an affordable component in there, it couldn't work. Now, by special permit, does it mean that the planning board could say, okay, this doesn't need that, or would it be an absolute has to be 25%? And I'll end it with, on the Dean Ave project, a little different, there was $1.5 million environmental cleanup on there with asbestos, underground oil in a water resource district in the town of Franklin, which benefited the town of Franklin. There is permitting fees. They paid $700,000 for off-site improvements. Between the permit fees, INI fees, the $700,000, the cleanup, they spent close to $3 million before they even thought of putting a shovel in the ground. Therefore, there's no way that project could have also put in a 25% component. Can each project be weighed on itself, or is it an absolute mandate? Anything over 3 is 25%. That's my question.
Okay.
Ryan, I'll let you answer that.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah, but I've done a lot of studies.
I'm glad you did the work, because inclusionary zoning, in general, it's not that hard to understand. It really isn't. That the concept is there, but each community does their own thing, obviously, to a point. Now the incentive part, that one can be difficult. For instance, if we included subdivisions in it and we said that you have to have a certain amount of percent, but if you can have a smaller lot if you had affordable units. I mean, there are ways to do things like that, obviously. But the more you add into it something, the more complicated you get. And I think you can, working with the housing trusts, you know, I mean, there are ways a developer, if they really want to do a multifamily project, there are ways to make these things happen. I understand that, you know, Dean Ave, great, you know, it's a great project. You got a lot of units that are going in there. And yes, it was a brownfield. It was a site next to the tracks. It had, it was a funky location with the corner, you know, corner of the road. You know, a lot of things are happening related to that, and sidewalk improvements. And so, yeah, I mean, that would not have happened as it happened, maybe with the affordable units. It would have been a different type of project if anything happened there. Understood. And the issue that we're dealing with is a couple issues. We want to maintain above a 10% affordable, so we don't have 40B projects worst on the town. That's an important concept to remember, that if we had, say, multifamily projects over the next 5 years where 400 or 500 units were approved and none of them were affordable units, we after 10 years from now, when the next census takes place, we would be struggling. We probably would not be at 10%. And so we're going to be okay, probably. I'm assuming, I don't know what the census is, because I can't, but I'm assuming we're going to be okay this time around. But 10 years from now, we need to look ahead. We have to make sure that we do maintain the 10%. Ongoing. We don't want to find ourselves in a predicament. And you know, some of us are going to be retired by then, and they shouldn't care. Well, they should care, because the fact is, the town of Franklin should be controlling the type of development that is appropriate for the community, instead of just being in a situation where you have the 40B developer come in and say, "This is what I want," and they usually get what they want or close to it. As far as incentives, if a person wanted to do a tax increment financing agreement on something like that, the town council has the ability to to negotiate that with a developer. If they have the type of development that the town wants, town council can go and negotiate that. You can work with me and Jamie, and we can work something out. We work with the Mass Office of Business Development. So that's something that is a possible incentive. Until a few years ago, that wasn't a possibility for that type of development in this town. You actually had to be within an economic opportunity area, but that no longer applies. So any development throughout the town, if it's what the town wants, they can apply for tax increment financing for the town. So that's there. There's also incentives for housing at the state level. So if you apply for tax breaks of some sort or another, you can also do that. Yes, INI fees and all those other things, that's something that if you work out a tax increment finance agreement, maybe you say, well, you know, I won't push too much on the percentages or whatever the case may be, but I like a break on the INI. That's negotiation with the town on a development that the town wants to see. When it goes through the planning board, okay, that's the planning board is looking at the development and the 25%. That's what they're looking at. The way that our bylaw is written here, that's not negotiable. It's a 25. It's 15 and 10 percent. So if we want to change that, that's fine. I'll go with it. But I think that right now we're putting down we're giving the planning board, not the zoning board of appeals, the say on a large or any size multifamily development. And we're getting moderate income units and the lower income units, and we're maintaining hopefully the 10%. So I think those are good things that we really look at. If there are specific changes that somebody wants to see, then you should probably get something, sit down and talk about it. But I wrote down a few of the things as you're talking, Joe, but I didn't get every word that you're saying, because there are a lot of issues out there, and you did a lot of research.
I'm not talking strictly through the chair, not strictly on just money incentives, but maybe the planning board could allow an extra story, because now the man's land cost is the same, the roof cost is the same. By adding a story allows him to put that extra units in at a minimal cost because some of the structure's done. Maybe if it's in a downtown area, there'd be some waiver. I don't know if we can waive all parking, but a reduction on parking, because if it's designed more for a downtown type living atmosphere.
Well, while we talk about those two issues that you just mentioned, as far as the number of units, the number of units are designated in the use regulation, the use table, okay, under the residential, that's attachment 7 in the zoning bylaw. So depending on what zoning district you're in, will allow, it's how many units in the C1 and the general residential 5, it's still one unit per 1,000 square feet, which is very, very dense, obviously.
Correct.
That's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with the zoning regulation and the number of units. So if somebody came in and wanted to actually max out and put one unit per 1,000, and then the planning board would be, just like you do with any other project that comes forward like that, it's a special permit. You assess the property, project. You're looking at the safety issues and all the other things, and you're saying if this thing works for the community or the neighborhood, more than a community, I guess. But you have specific things that you have to address, as you know, with a special permit. So now, as far as the waiving parking, that's the same issue. Right now, planning board, as you know, can waive down the number of parking on a case by case basis. So nothing would change. It's still, you're still reviewing a project in the same way. Okay. If the developer were to say, this is, this, you're going to get this is an awesome project and you're going to get 25% of affordable here. I want to get in, instead of 30 units, I want to get 36 units or whatever the case may be. Whatever it is within the zoning bylaw, I mean, you have that maximum that you can go with. If we want to change that down the road, then we're changing the use table itself. We're not changing the affordable inclusionary zoning bylaw. You're changing the use table and how many are allowed. So again, it's designed to work with all the other sections of the document.
And just one last comment to the chair, I'd like to comment on that. And I'd give an example, the road going down to DNAV. DNAV itself is residential 4. You get a 10,000 square foot lot. Yes, it's legally allowed to put 10 units, but you know with what our current bylaws are with impervious coverage and everything else and parking requirements, you're never going to get 10 units unless you go high. You're not going to go wide. So it self-corrects itself and really restricts. But on if someone came in on a downtown project like that, residential 4, and wanted to put even 6 or 7 units in, he couldn't do that on a 10,000 square foot lot. Even though he's got the right, it looks good on paper, he can put 10. But you can't because it self-corrects with all our other bylaws. Parking, impervious coverage.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Let me also just throw in the line that Joe is concerned about, if there were a specific project, particularly in the downtown, you still have the statutory mechanism of General Laws Chapter 40R that allows you to work with a local community to handcraft a project and all the amenities, some of the concerns he was addressing. That's still there. That's a state statute, and that's something that's available notwithstanding the zoning.
Okay. Thank you, Attorney Sorrell. Joe, are you all?
I'll sit back for a while. Maybe someone else got comments. I'd like to listen to what they have to say, and then maybe I'll try to kick in at the end.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to go back to Councilor Jones. He had his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Brian said one of the things I was going to ask about the possibility of offering a TIF or a tax incremental financing in response to potential, allowing them to do the development. A question that came up was, Joe, this is kind of to your point, you said the 20 units that they have difficulty trying to get rid of because it's not, they're hard to get rid of, they held on to them for years. Is there a possibility, and it's probably a question to Attorney Sorrell or to Brian, is there a possibility where for whatever units that are low income or middle income that the town is trying to support, would it be possible for us to hold taxes on units that aren't sold for the duration of the time that they're unsold for? In other words, if there were 20 units that were not selling in a particular project, could we actually put a hold on the taxes that are allowed on those potential units for the duration of the time that it's unsold for, until they actually get sold or become occupied?
The short answer is no. You're very restricted in terms of what the state will allow a municipality to do with respect to tax laws. They generally apply across the board. That being said, whether there would be a basis for an abatement, which is a highly individualized determination by the assessors, I suppose it's possible. The other alternative would be to, again, work it up front some way of how the project is approved in the first place that would perhaps address that. Bear in mind that affordable units are taxed at a reduced rate.
Understood.
Because in fact, they are affordable units, so that's not, the developer's not taking the full hit on those. If they're not constructed yet, or if it's phased, the project is phased, given the current state of the law, they're probably not taxed either.
Understood. Thank you, Mark. That was my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Councilor Jones. Okay, I'm going to go to to Andy, Councilor Bassanti, and then I have, there's a question out in the audience. We'll get to you, Lisa. Okay. Okay, Andy.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I think I heard everything I wanted to hear from both Brian and Mark Sorrell. But you know, if I can fast forward this a little, just so I can put a model in my head about how this would possibly go down. Okay, so we have a developer. He's semi-intrigued by this kind of zoning, yet really not way over the top with it. So he brings it forward to the planning board. And as part of his site plan initiatives and keeping in mind the 25% affordability component, he puts in his special permit plan or part of his special permit criteria as part of his site plan that he might ask for a waiver for parking or green space or impervious coverage and or another story. Did I hear that correctly, that can be considered as part of the present day site plan criteria? And I'm not calling them incentives, but to help him make these things work, because if this thing becomes too draconian for developers, it's not gonna happen. And then we'll end up with nothing. And that's what I don't wanna see happen. So I wanna see this thing at least happen on some level. And if we make it too tough, then we'll get nothing. So either one of you can answer that as part of a site plan criteria going forward. So
the mechanism already exists for the planning board, as Brian indicated, to waive down parking and make some other concessions. As far as an additional story, that's something that would have to be provided in the zoning district as an option, given the authority to the planning board. They do not have the authority to simply tack on an added story because a developer's requesting it in a particular project. And then again, to go back to what I alluded to earlier, the 40R under state law is essentially legalized spot zoning. So it gives you tremendous flexibility working with a developer in advance to design a district to accommodate the project the developer's proposing. So that's definitely, in my opinion, a viable alternative from a legal standpoint.
Is that a mixed use? Is that the mixed use marker?
It can be. Okay. Absolutely can be.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
I have a quick note on...
Go ahead, Brian.
On the number of stories. Currently, our zoning regulations allow, by special permit, an additional story in certain zoning districts. However, they do not apply right now to any of the residential zoning districts. They do apply to, for instance, C1. So if you wanted to get an additional story there, you'd be going from multifamily affordable units 25%, you'd get out, and so that's one special permit there. Then you have an additional special permit for an additional story. If you wanted to do that, you could do that in the C1 district. I don't think it really would apply to the others because we don't allow residential uses in the other districts in most cases anyway. A downtown commercial zone also. That does, we could have a special permit.
The granting authority would be the ZBA or the planning board? Who would be the granting authority?
Again? It would be the planning board special permit. It would be the same time as you go forward with the special permit for the affordable.
So there are some latitude going forward for a developer if he goes before the planning board. He can ask, at least, I suppose.
I think Brian's
there's
can't really hear him.
By utilizing the existing zoning bylaws, there's way to actually, but with it, what it appears at first look, if down the road after you've approved this, you want to focus additional housing and the ability to get an additional floor in a and in a certain zone, then the town can actually do that. The town can decide to change the zoning bylaws and the use table and things of that nature.
Thank you. I'll release the floor, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Councilor Bisanti. So Tony, I see that you have a question, but I told Lisa I would go to her. Okay, so after Lisa's done, we'll go to Tony. Lisa Audette, you have a question out in the audience?
Yes, Lisa Audette, the Executive Director of the Franklin Housing Authority. I was wondering if there potentially could be any advantage to the Housing Authority expanding its housing stock through some kind of program here. Is it possible perhaps that a developer could contribute enough money to the Housing Authority to put in a rental unit that would be affordable through perpetuity? You know, is there other options that maybe could help the Housing Authority, which would help the low income, rental market in the town? I apologize, I haven't been here through the beginning of this. I got frozen out and then, but I am interested in trying to help the Housing Authority develop more affordable rental units, and maybe there's some kind of an avenue here that we can be included.
Thank you for your question. I think maybe Mark or Brian could answer that, right?
I'd be happy to, through the chair. There is an option in here for off-site affordable units. So if there is a developer that wants to put a 10 units on a certain lot and they don't want to put the affordable units there, then you can get the equal value on off-site housing units. Or they could purchase a property, for instance, and do it that way. So there are ways to work with the Housing Authority or the Affordable Housing Trust on certain projects. It really depends on how interested the developer is and how interested the town is to work together on those.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Does that answer your question, Lisa?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we're gonna go to Tony. Tony Padula. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you through my phone because I just can't get my computer to completely operate. Yes, I have a few questions. I did a little bit of research myself. Inclusionary zoning, when it was developed in the 70s in response to snob zoning and exclusionary zoning. Massachusetts, New Jersey, and California basically are the godfathers of this of all this zoning. What I don't understand is I heard three or more, and 95% of the studies that I've done in different parts of the country, including Massachusetts, and of course your old town, Cambridge, Jamie, is 10%, is 10 units or more. So why are we going down to three or more? That was one question. The other things I found, the critics to this say that by having inclusionary zoning, they say that the policy reduces housing and increases the prices actually of market value houses in a town. So the tool is used in cities, but it's not really used in a lot of urban areas. You mentioned Norfolk, Wrentham, in surrounding towns, but they're not even close to their 10%, these towns that you've mentioned. And we are. The other thing is developers, okay, developers could have the option to build BMR below market rate units at a separate site, which Brian mentioned, and or contribute to a housing fund, which Lisa was talking about. So that does happen. What I don't want to see is, I don't like the talk that another story might be allowed, or that we give huge density bonuses to developers, because now we're right back into 40Bs. And a 40B, by the way, is inclusionary zoning. All right, so we already have a mechanism for inclusionary zoning that we're using right now. And if we keep giving these density bonuses or waive our zoning and our infrastructure, as stories, parking, curbing, whatever, and all these incentives, what is the difference between allowing 40Bs to come in where they can be developed, because of course it's 5 acres or more, and they have to have sewage, they have to have sufficient water. The other thing is, there was a study done. Let me see. Okay, UC Berkeley from California, with their Housing Innovation Center. They did a study, and their program found that it reduced by adopting this in the cities, it reduced their revenue by 6 to 19%, their tax revenue. And it dropped production of home building from 6 to 12%. And I know that it's not a cost to the town, but it's a cost to the developer to put this inclusionary zoning in. So I realize it's free for the town, but it's also an added expense to the builder. The builder, we've already adopted stretch laws, more insulation in houses, which is a cost per unit. Expensive cost, no matter how big the project is. So in ending, I'll just give you what Chambers has for their bylaw. They've had it since 1998. 20% of the floor space, 10 or more units it applies to, and they're giving density bonuses to the developers of 30%, which is basically defeating the whole purpose. Renters, 30% of the income, and that includes rent and utilities, studio apartments, 25% of their income, rent and utilities, and any households making 90% of the median income are eligible. So, I mean, with that said, we wouldn't have Eagle's Nest. We wouldn't have the GNAB project, we wouldn't have Brooks Farm, and I believe we wouldn't have Brookview. So personally, I feel that it should be a ballot question, because once this goes in and once we pass the bylaw, then of course, they're gonna keep adding amendments and amendments and amendments. So that's my take. Thank you.
Tony, can I ask you a question to clarify something?
Sure.
Your audio was kind of blurry for me. So I think you asked what was the difference between this and a 40B? Is that what you asked?
Yes, I did.
Okay, all right. So maybe we can get an answer to that.
What was that the only thing you heard?
Oh, we heard it all.
I heard it.
I heard you loud and clear, Tony.
You heard me that, right?
I couldn't hear any of that.
Yes, we can hear you, Mark.
All right, so the difference is if, as Brian alluded to, sometime in the future, you drop below 10%, you have no control over 40Bs when they come in terms of what the developer is proposing to do, in terms of the particular site, the size of the project, the nature of the project, all those types of things. Those are out of the town's control once you drop below 10%. So you could drop down by an infinitesimal amount. You're just barely below 10%. That allows a developer to come in with a maximum size project if they so choose, which is like, I think, 200 units. It's not just to get back to 10%. Once you're under it, you're fair game for whatever a developer proposes, and that's the difference.
Okay, thank you. Did that answer your question, Tony?
Yeah, it did answer my question. I still think it should be a ballot question. I don't think it's meant for an urban area. And I would like to see the voters vote on this for the town of Franklin, because I don't think it's just something that should be passed around to a EDC meeting and not have the majority of the public aware of this. And all the
this is proposed zoning. It's clearly town council authority. It's not anything that's subject to a ballot question.
Okay. I see Joe's hand up, but I'm gonna go to Jamie Helen right now. He's raised his hand in the participants area for a while now, and then we'll go to Joe after that.
Actually, Madam Chair, I'll let Mr. Halligan go, because I was going to try to do a couple of summary comments on a few of the things that a few people said.
Okay. All right. So we'll give Joe the floor again, and then I think Councillor Bisanti has another comment too.
Okay. Thank you very much to the chair. Where it's going to be a planning board special permit through the special permit authority, could it be written in such a way that if there is a rare circumstance where the town wants a project to happen, whatever the mechanics are, the planning board could waive the 25% affordable on a particular project where it is a special permit? That's one question. And another question would be, this is similar to what I heard on Chestnut Street, where there's 10 units going in under a veterans program. And the question come up, well, I'm going to build these units and two of them are going to be for veterans only. What if there's no takers? Would there be some kind of mechanism that would allow the developer, if there are no takers for the units, whether it's rental or condos for sale, to allow him to sell these after a certain period of time? That's my question.
Okay. Brian or Mark, I think, could answer that, right?
I think so. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark, if you could.
Yeah, depending how it's worded, the planning board or the special permit granting authority would not have the authority to waive the affordable percentages, because it's in the bylaw and that's not something within their authority. The issue of inability to sell units can be problematical, frankly. Again, certainly the first go-around, the developer is going to be restricted by what the bylaw provided and the special permit. If they're unable to sell the units, generally because there's been a major... It's not an individualized thing. It's the entire economy's a real estate downturn. Then that becomes problematical, and it's a matter of going back to the planning board and asking under those circumstances for modification of the special permit.
Which would allow no affordable?
It might provide some kind of temporary relief. It might be that, again, this is off the top of my head, but in order to keep the project viable, they might allow for some period of time for the units to be rented for at market rates or something like that, but still retain the ultimate affordability requirement.
I understand. I guess my only comment and last comment would be is, I don't really see any upside for a developer to be excited to come here and do this, because it seems like there's no incentives. If the economy gets hurt, he really can't sell the units. He can't get waived the percentage if it's a financial burden to try to make something happen that the town really wants. Similar to the Dean Ave project, that was on the master plan. The town really wanted that. Jeff really wanted that. Had that been imposed, we would have missed out on a project like that with a major cleanup and a water resource. I mean, I can go on and on, but there's no real incentive for a guy to be excited to do this. It's almost like they're being forced to do this, where I would like to, I think we're on the right track. We need it. But I'd like to see developers be excited to come to town and want to get involved in projects like this. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. I just want to remind people that we have a few minutes left because the planning board has a meeting at 7, I believe. And
yes.
Andy, do you have another comment, or we'll go to Jamie?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I hear what Joe Halligan's saying, and I've also fielded some comments in my emails. Let's stay focused on what this is all about. First of all, we are at a very high percentage of that 40Bs, and I don't think we ever really want to see 40Bs come back, and there's a tremendous amount of differences. A 40B developer can come to town, and he can build the ugliest, he can put up like an army barracks and call it a 40B. And that was one of the big distinctions, I think, between this and an inclusionary affordability project. And the other focus is, you know, a lot of us who have kids and grandkids, you know, when a starter home in Franklin is right around $450,000, I'm hoping those thresholds can come down. But, you know, fielding Tony, Chairman Padula's and Vice Chairman Halligan's comments, I do agree some of these thresholds and percentages might need another look. And the numbers in came, that kind of surprised me what Tony said, that the thresholds are like 10 and 10%. 10 units at
10, stuff like that. 10 units or above.
What's that? I'm sorry.
10 units or above.
Right. So, I mean, I think some of those thresholds and percentages might need another look at. And but I think in theory and right now, I think that it was a fantastic job what the staff did. And I like it going forward. I don't know if it needs tweaking. I'll leave it up to the rest of you guys to talk about. But I'll just say that I think in theory we're on to something pretty good. Thank you very much,
Councilor Passante. Let's go down to Jamie Helen, Town Administrator.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, you know, actually, I think this was, you know, as I sat back here and I haven't really spoken much and left it to, you know, the folks to give a lot of feedback, as well as, you know, the community planning director and town attorney. I think this was, you know, going back a few weeks, this was the meeting we were going to have in mid-March. Mm-hmm. And I think this was the kind of discussion that you, the staff, and really I hope all of you were really looking to have, to be truthful. And, you know, this isn't something that's really been presented publicly in Franklin in the past. We're actually quite proud to get it to this point. And I think that everything that was said tonight are, you know, in my view from 30,000 feet per se, I think it was really good feedback. And I think there's a lot of support for what we're doing here. I think we recognize the problem in Franklin. And, you know, I was sitting here earlier kind of lining up a couple of options, right? I mean, the EDC tonight has a piece of legislation before them. And on the one hand, we could, you know, take this, one option is to take this back to the staff level, take a lot of this feedback and try to work around the edges to try to see if there's something we could build and then bring it back to the EDC, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks or whatever the staff believes needs time. Or, you know, the second choice is to move it to the council tonight, refer it to the planning board. Of course, there'll be a debate at the council in all likelihood, as there should be, move it to the planning board and then let offer them a different proposal. But after hearing from all of this discussion for the last, you know, 45 minutes, I think it's fairly obvious to me that, you know, with the consent of the EDC that, you know, maybe at our you know, at a staff meeting coming up here this week, the town attorney and I and Mr. Tabiner and Amy and the other staff can take some of this feedback and see what our options are to move forward. I thought this was a really good discussion. A couple of things I just wanted to mention. You know, in terms of 40Bs, you know, in my view, from both living in Franklin and otherwhere, nobody wants to see 40Bs, or very few people do. Cottage Street, you can go down the list of the ones that become very unpopular. And ultimately, they do get crammed down your throat, as the town attorney said. You really have no control over where they go. We have one up in the industrial park. The difference here with inclusionary zoning is it's a concerted effort that the community is deciding itself. And I think that is the central difference between a 40B and what we're trying to do with inclusionary zoning. I think the point that Mr. Halligan made and others about incentives is something that is something of a valid point. And I think there were a whole bunch of options that Mr. Halligan and others have thrown out on the table as ideas. And I'd like to at least take the time in the next week or two to really explore those with Brian and Amy and Mark. And you know, we were talking about 40R, and we're talking about different things with condos. Lisa Audette had a fantastic idea about whether those options with housing authorities.
The council is going to have that another debate on the CPA at a future meeting in a week or two. And whether there's, you know, in a town like Franklin, I think Mr. Halligan makes a good point. You know, there is not a lot of land. There is scarce amounts of land left. We are not the town of Deerfield or Florida, where there's just, you know, acres and acres of, to be developed here or there. So I would say that using Cambridge and Newton as examples also does not fit our character as well. I mean, those are dense, large cities that have different redevelopment authorities around them. The dynamics are completely different. And the housing markets in those two communities are about, you know, are certainly one of the, you know, the highest median housing prices, you know, anywhere in the country, let alone just Massachusetts. I think it's apples to oranges when we're talking about Cambridge and Newton. I think what I'd like to see from the staff is start looking at a little bit more of the, you know, the Holliston's, Hopkinton's, Medway's, the communities a little bit more around us along 495 to see if maybe we can frame some of the dynamics around there. I think they make some great points. And we have a suburban problem in Franklin, not really an urban problem like a Cambridge or Newton. Those dynamics are just are completely different. And I do agree with the town attorney to final on my final comment on the ballot initiative. Something like this, as complicated as this, you know, I think in the long run, no matter where the citizens vote, one of my fears is then you kind of politically in some ways take away your ability to modify that bylaw down the road. I don't have any doubt as I sit here today going on the record that whatever the council and the planning board and others decide to hopefully put through, like a lot of our zoning bylaws, will require at some point some tweaks. That's just the nature of these types of decisions. And I would hate to see, honestly, a political fight over something that I think on this phone call, and I think others are going to show a lot of support. I think it's really just about trying to, you know, work within the framework we've created and to do that. So, you know, my recommendation, Madam Chair, if the EDC was so inclined, is to go with my former recommendation number one of maybe allowing us a couple weeks to have a staff discussion over the comments provided tonight and do some additional outreach and maybe come back with some with a different proposal or something that's you know, based off this feedback in a few weeks.
Okay. All right. I think that's a great idea. I think we really need something like this because we want to stay above the 10% line. Yep. Like how it has moderate income housing as well. And that could fit into the CPA. I think the staff has done an excellent job, and I know you guys all want to work on it a little bit more. Councilor Jones has one more quick comment, hopefully, because it's 10 of 7, so we have to move on.
Oh, I know they got to go. Okay. Just in regards to the town administrator's comments, I totally agree. I think this definitely should be allowed to go back to the departments to be discussed further. And I think Councilor Bisanti would agree with me. And along with many of the comments that was said tonight to try and tweak this a little bit more, bring it back to us. There's really no rush. I mean, with the economic economy, with the economy that we're in right now, with a lot of uncertainty, especially in the construction trades, what direction things are going, we definitely have a little bit of time to give this some further thought. So giving it back to the departments to give it some tweaking, I'm completely all for it. I would definitely like to see this come to full council so we can get the public involved. And I do think it is the purview of the council to bring this under consideration.
Thank you for your comments, Councilor Jones. So I guess it's a, do we need to vote to, we just need to say we're gonna adjourn, right?
Just adjourn, this can go back to the departments.
Okay. So thank you everybody. Town administrator, you know, go take this back to the staff. Thank you for all the staff for all your hard work. I think it's really great. Thanks for all the comments out there. It's really important to get feedback while we're trying to do something a little different. So thank you all, and I will accept a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Do you have a second?
Second.
Can't hear you.
Second.
Okay, let's we have to do a
I got roll call here.
Got a roll call.
A roll call vote. So let's go. Councilor Bisanti.
Yes.
Councilor Jones.
Yes.
Chair. Yes. Non-debatable.
Thank you, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Great job.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Tony.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
See everybody. Good night. Enjoy your night, everybody.
This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but I can't do it alone. I can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like this, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is entitled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.